Welcome to The Intuitive Home.
So I was thinking about this today, how I start out every podcast talking about how I met the person on the podcast, that's the guest. And at first I was like, does that make sense? And I was like, yeah, it does, because my business is really about, really care about relationships and how relationships started. So now I feel better about starting that way.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I met Justin in a very intense moment of our lives when we were working on a project our friend is putting on called Hunters of Avalon, which is a big live immersive Dungeons & Dragons live action role play escape room experience.
Yeah, I wish there was an easier way to say it, and Todd will say there is an easier way that he wishes we just used, but that's all of it in a nutshell. Yeah, pretty much.
So Justin did a lot of cool like Arduino work and also just did some other amazing work. And I remember there's even one time I was working on something trying to get these stupid triangles right. I was like, I can't get these to freaking fit in this thing. And then Justin comes over and it's like, it's this. I'm like, thank you. That was driving me insane.
Yeah, that was I mean, I went into that knowing a little bit of Arduino and graphic design and 3D modeling, and Todd had the laser cutter. And by the end of it, it was like I had effort into, I swear, almost everything in that event. Like, there were Arduino boxes built for the vendor stalls. There were Arduino boxes built for any of the class challenges. There was, everything was laser cut. We used the laser cutter for absolutely everything, including those triangles for the a geodesic dome that was supposed to be a dragon heart. That one incorporated absolutely everything. It was like woodworking, laser cutting, Arduinos, painting, audio engineering, and just everything into that one thing. And,
yeah, that's where I learned so many of the skills was through doing that, because I learned literally everything.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, tremendous amount of fun. So now you get five words. What are five words you use to describe yourself?
I had someone ask me this recently, and it like sent me into a spiral. They were like, what's your personality? Like, and it's like, what in like one word, how would you describe yourself? I was like, I have no idea. And then they backed off, which was good. But yeah, five words is a little more lenient. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And you can use seven if you want. I just say five.
Short.
I pick a random number.
What's your mantra is the question. I think that honest answer would vary day to day, which is kind of why I would answer it like just kind of a stew of creative messes. It's a million hobbies, trying to incorporate creativity to work and work to creativity, and have that all kind of reflect back on, you know, what my self-work is. So yeah, it's kind of just a stew of creative messes, I think, is the shortest way to say it, which I realize is ironic talking to someone who focuses on organization as I show up to a podcast and say I'm a mess of different things, but it's fun.
Although I can argue I am too, because
the goal is organization, the path there is messy. So
right. Yeah. And that's straight up true, man.
Yeah, like, absolutely. Even
when you're doing organizing, I tell my clients it gets worse before it gets better.
Absolutely.
You get a lot of stuff thrown all over the place.
You got to pull everything out, figure out where it goes before you can put it anywhere.
Exactly.
Even your personality traits. You got to put it all on the table.
See what they are.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So yeah, that's, I'm not trying to plug myself at all here, my Insta for art stuff is Craftwork as Artwork. And it's supposed to be about, you know, using craft type of skills, whether or not that's like your professional craft or just like physical, tangible craft, and putting that into something expressive. So artwork. And it's kind of born out of this
ethics retreat I went on with some other scientists. It was funded by, like, I think the NIH partly and partly ASU to go out and have a weekend of discussion about what ethics is in science. And the theme of it was craft work as self work. So like, how is what we do as professionals really building ourselves up and our, you know, mental health, anything like that, you know, the self work. And I guess the, you know, the long paraphrase that I would use is craft work as artwork as self work, because that middle part of expression is kind of the translation of what you're doing professionally to how that's benefiting yourself. And yeah, I kind of got lost there.
And I liked it not at all. I mean, I'm with you. I think that's one of the most interesting parts about art in general is its ability to help the artist work through whatever they're going through. Like, even me right now is like going through some shit and I'm like, maybe I need to do some art. Really work through this a little bit and do some drawings about it, or I don't know.
And I think people can recognize that in the art. Like, that's when it's authentic, is when it's personal processing. And if we keep that in the focus of our artistic efforts and using whatever skills we have to do those artistic efforts, then it remains authentic. And then it does become about processing whatever our mental state is. And then everything ties together. All the professional, arduous shit we deal with is expressive and comes back to ourselves. It's kind of like, how do we use our day to day to invest back in ourselves? And that middle ground is artistic expression. Yeah.
I like it. What's your like setup for like at home?
My setup at home is cramped. So I, due to some life changes recently, have downsized to a studio casita, but it, you know, has motivated me to be a little more minimalist and a little more like, the only things in my studio are things that I actually care about and want to, you know, use and express with. So, it's kind of nice cause it's like concentrated me. It's, you know, there aren't rooms separating the different things I want to do. There aren't, you know, physical barriers between it. So there's like a corner that's like my home PC that is surrounded by music stuff. And then there's, the, you know, living area. It's kind of like the couch with a TV, but under the TV are all my art supplies that if I want to dive into any of that, I can. Underneath the coffee table against the wall are like different bags that I have. So there's like a photography bag and a work bag and a camping bag. So if I need to just like grab one thing that has all that gear, that's good to go. So like everything's kind of like streamlined to be able to do shit, but not separated at all. You know, it's all one space, so it's all kind of congruous.
Yeah, it's all there.
And like, you know, little workout area next to the bed, so that like if I have the motivation when I wake up, it's there, ready to go.
That's the only way I work out. Yeah. Like I stopped working out when I moved in here because my pull-up bar, I was just like, this thing sucks. I need a new one. Mm-hmm. And I have a plan to build a whole crazy fold-up gym basically in my room. But again, another project that needs to get that I need to get around to, which is a really important one because I need that thing to for daily life. But
absolutely,
but I pulled out the my, you know, I have my kettlebell and some like I got some like pull up blocks that I'm excited about that I'll get after. But if that's not in there and it's not in my house, I'm not doing it. And I have a pull up bar in my apartment. They have a nice thing with dumbbells and everything, but I just don't walk over there. I just
because
it's like I gotta get ready. I just like need to be here and just pump it out.
I'm always impressed with the people that really take the time to drive to the gym,
dude, get prepped
at the gym.
I used to be one of those people.
Go work out there, shower afterwards, drive home, and then go to work. Like, no, what? Like, if I can wake up and do a simple dumbbell workout next to my bed, like, it's just like a yoga mat and dumbbells.
Boom.
And if I wake up and I have the motivation, I'm going to do that. It takes a half hour and it makes my day a million times better, but it doesn't waste the hour it would take to just get somewhere and get back.
Dude, totally.
It's, even if that's walking across the apartment complex, like it's
absolutely
as vain as it is, it's like putting on the right workout clothes and showing up there.
Yeah.
Like, I don't like working out in public if like I'm I haven't showered beforehand. So it's like, it's a million mental things. And it's just like, nope.
So many, and there's only the, all those barriers. You guys got to remove all those barriers. Yep. Just
if I remove all those barriers, it's so much more streamlined and it's good. And it takes up like what? 10 square feet, like a yoga mat.
Oh yeah.
It's nothing.
And it rolls up and goes away, you know? Exactly. For me, I put on like 20 pounds just by doing pull-ups, push-ups, dips, and kettlebells.
Oh.
And a little bit of like sprinting and whatever. But for the, like, I was like, what? But I didn't, like, I had my weighed myself for the whole time I was doing it. And I went home and weighed myself. I was like, oh my God. How did I do? I what? Did all this. Oh shit.
It's all amazing what calisthenics did. It's like,
just
wow.
Minimal 15 minutes
Greeks
a day.
The Greeks didn't have gyms. Uh-uh. They didn't lift dumbbells.
Yeah, you see those statues?
Yeah. They just did calisthenics and physical exercise and body weight stuff. Like, yeah. And it works because that's all you really need. If you can manipulate your own body, you're probably fit. You don't need to be benching 300 pounds.
No, any of that. And that's what I love. That's like end goals, like really like full body control, right? Mm-hmm. Just like gymnastic style can do a lot of weird, cool control movement and everything's kind of working together instead of like isometric,
mm-hmm.
single.
Whatever. Yeah, absolutely.
But all right, let's go into this question. So what are some possible ways that human brain interface could make the experience in our homes better? And, you know, like we talked about before, there's not much of that possible today, but I'm just, you know, looking into the future, let's even say 50 to 100 years when this is potentially a real thing, which I know scares a lot of people. how might that be sweet? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'll start this off by saying, you know, professionally, like we've talked a lot about the projects I've worked on.
Yeah,
things. Professionally, I'm a neurophysiologist. I do somatosensory physiology, recording somatosensory cortex, encoding textures, encoding touch, and peripheral nerve stimulation to kind of try to recreate that. That's like my first foray into brain-computer interfaces or BCIs. And then I got more involved with neuromodulation BCIs. So how can we change the brain state to better suit our goals? Falls into neurofeedback, but you know, neuromodulation is a really wide field that can cover breath work is neuromodulation.
Oh, interesting.
Or deep brain stimulation for Parkinsonian, symptoms. That's neuromodulation. So it's all, it could be insanely invasive and medical, or can be very approachable, I guess is the right word. So that's a lot of the expertise I have. And when we start talking about BCIs, most people immediately want to jump to the idea of controlling things with their mind or receiving information from their environment with their mind. Those kind of things just aren't approachable at present due to technology. Like it's just purely technological limitations. Of,
right.
There's a lot of information out there. How does the brain encode things? How do we decode brain activity? But having something that can have the spatial resolution and the temporal resolution to really create an effective interface is just not there yet. I have a friend who is on a team at Facebook who is working on, I think they have a 10-year goal of creating a headset that can be a typer, a speller, basically. So you just think, what you're going to post on Facebook, and it's going to be able to decode that and just do that. And obviously that tech has a million other implications. If you can create, right now, just speaking to your phone, you can do almost anything. So if you can just think to your phone, all those capabilities open up. Very potential. And that's like a 10-year plan by one of the most powerful companies on the planet. So it's very
also
likely.
And a lot of people are scared. Like, yeah. That's gonna scare a lot.
Yeah. And the idea is like, oh, it can read your thoughts.
Yeah.
And it's, I don't know if it can read thoughts because there is a certain amount of intentionality that comes from like trying to spell something versus just picking up random thoughts.
Right.
It's like literally a different part of the brain that they're probably going to look at. There's like a center of your brain that is for speech production that's even active when you think about speaking. So I would assume that team is looking at recording from that part of the brain.
Right.
Now, thinking about speaking is different than having spontaneous thoughts. So, like, the things people are afraid of are a little misguided.
Gotcha.
And something similar popped up with the Neuralink demo recently, where it was like they claimed it was predicting the monkey's brain.
Yeah.
And people really freaked out about that.
Yeah.
I heard that on like multiple podcasts and talked to people, and they're like, you can predict what you're going to do. It's like, well, no. I mean, yes, it can predict the motor action you are planning to make.
Right.
And that's because you're already thinking about planning it.
Right.
So it's not predicting something you don't have autonomy over.
Yeah.
It's really just decreasing the latency between thought and action.
Right.
So that is really interesting.
Oh, it's fascinating.
But it's not as scary as people make it out to be.
Yeah, because it's like, for that to really work, it's just what's going. And that's so hard. Even just like that little sliver of the brain, like, how do you even figure out what word someone's going to think about? Like,
yeah, no, it's you know, probably going to be a lot of neural networks and deep learning. And what's going to be amazing is, you know, watching this technology evolve parallel to the advances in training neural networks. Eventually, I mean, you know, you play a video game, you have the tutorial, right? And you have the, okay, you look up with the joystick, look down, and you spend 5 minutes training on how to do it, and then you can do everything in the game. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, same thing for neural networks eventually. You know, you're going to have some training montage, and you're going to say, okay, think of these things, and it's going to pick up on what your cortex is doing with relation to that device, and it's going to train on that. And it might not be perfect, but you know, we suffer through predictive text right now, and it works for most of the time.
Yeah, it gets you there.
And exactly. And it's going to be the same thing. It's going to be predictive text tied with what your brain's doing and everything else in the algorithm on what you might say in the first place. So, yeah, it's that's probably the most impressive and like most soon technology to come onto the market will be a BCI speller that's non-invasive. There are things out there, like the Emotive headset is like a 8-channel EEG thing that I think you can set up to do cursor control on a computer. Like right now, I think you can go buy that and hook it up to your computer and you can control, you know, X, Y coordinates.
With your mind?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. But it's a pain. It's so much worse than a mouse.
Oh, yeah.
Like, put it on a headset, you have to train it, you have to make sure, and it's like you have to make sure the contacts are all good.
Like looking at the thing, and if you look anywhere else or think about anything else, it's gonna like fly all
exactly. And it's like right now, there's tech out there that might help in some way, but it's not better than you know, the simple things.
Like, I got one of the like Mayo, I think it was called, the, like, and you can control, you know, with gestures in the air and like swipe and whatever. And like, I tried that thing out, and it was just terrible.
Yeah,
it's like I mean, maybe work for music, like a lot of these things have like one real good use, and like
it's just next back, track,
next track, like, pause, play, and that's about it. And then everything else, you're like,
it's more a party trick than an actual benefit.
Exactly. Yeah. But like, it's one of those things like you want to work really well, because it seems like it'd be a lot better
if
it
can absolutely
be done well.
So yeah, the idea of like what could be benefited by BCIs in a home, man, for me, and this is probably just a function of getting older, it's just like, nothing is that hard in a home. Like, you know, lights, even what Hue and Google Home and things, like, yeah, there's like routines you can set, but that's really relinquishing control. It's not making it a new avenue of control.
Right.
It's like, oh, it's going to recognize that I'm home now because my phone GPS is near home, and it's going to turn on the lights, and that automation is really awesome.
Yeah.
But what neural tech is going to make it easier than just flipping a light switch? You know, for most able-bodied people, neural tech is just not going to be something that's easier than the things we're already trained on in our everyday life. The, you know, it's going to be medical advancements for people who are inaccessible to those things. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be really amazing once the tech gets there to interface with the internet of things that's already present. You know, people who can't flip on a light switch are going to be able to. People who can't speak are going to be able to type. People who you know, can't unlock the door or can now unlock the door. And you know, all of these things are going to be more approachable because it's just an information channel. But it's, I just, even in the 50 to 100 years, I don't see it being better for able-bodied people. ever.
Interesting.
And that's why, yeah. And it's that argument of really present in the research community. Really absent in the research community is the idea of transhumanism. There's not research out there to augment the human experience. There's the focus of research is to help people who are lacking the human experience.
Right, and help them get back to
exactly.
baseline.
There are a million steps before we move to anything transhumanist. Obviously, there are presently biohackers and people out there trying to do things. I know multiple people who have the like magnetic implant in their fingertip. Do you know anyone with that?
No.
No. So it's just like a little magnet yes. that they subdurally or subcutaneously inject into the fingertip.
Yeah.
And it just, you know, you start to be able to pick up magnetic fields a little bit nearer things. So
Yeah. Or and like another cool one is, what is it? There's another subdural one. Same thing, but like it tells you when you're facing north, it like vibrates mm-hmm. when you're facing north or something.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have like a great sense of direction because you always get a natural sense of where north is.
Mm-hmm.
Or I really do want an RFID chip.
So that's the other one I was going to talk about. People have that injected. A lot of them get it like in the meat between the thumb and the index finger. And they're able to just like log into their computer or whatever by just scanning it really quick.
Yeah, I like that. Else. If I have complete control over it and I bought that like,
mm-hmm.
you know, from a whatever and I have complete, I know what I put on it and it was mine. Like that's
well,
the
and
shit.
Or RFCs like, are only reading, right? So like there's not... it's not powered. It's not any of that. It's just only reading information. So yeah, the worry of it being like a tracker chip or anything is
not very good.
Yeah, so because they can't transmit. So
they didn't put it in our vaccines.
No, unless you got the Pfizer. I think that's the one that really came with the benefits of our NFC. Yeah.
Oh.
No, it's so I know people doing those biohacker things, and those are kind of useful, but I wouldn't really qualify those as BCIs.
Sure.
Those are just, I don't know, different keys to information that's already there. It's not, and maybe it is kind of new information, but
right.
it's not really brain computer
interface. No,
it's
no.
It's definitely
no,
not
no,
computer
no, no,
interface
no.
even.
No,
I
of
guess
course
the NFC could be. But yeah, so there are people experimenting with that, and there, you know, people experimenting with the CRISPR stuff. So there's always going to be, you know, homebrew biohackers trying to do this stuff. But we'll see when, if ever, you know, BCIs make their way into casual living.
Okay. All right. I like it. So is there any way that we can use neurofeedback and maybe, I don't know if I use the right term.
No, yeah,
there.
Neurofeedback.
Okay.
Yeah.
Neurofeedback to maybe help us do, or at least get done some of the tasks that we want to do and get done that we might also not really want to do.
Yeah. Neurofeedback is, you know, a complex term. Receiving information back about what your brain is doing is like, it's a skill that it's hard to receive training on, because how are you supposed to have this like interoception to what your own body is doing, let alone what your own brain is doing? I think, you know, in research, the idea of neurofeedback is very, very simple. Like you can put on an EEG head cap. It can measure out like a certain band wave power, like, you know, alpha band or beta, alpha, beta or gamma, are the three most common. And, you know, say you chose alpha band and you have a computer screen in front of you that is yellow and it turns red, the higher your alpha band power is. Well, if you put someone in that setup, they're going to be able to over time modulate their own alpha power. And be able to, with a little bit of feedback, start being able to understand how they can control their own mind, whether or not that's focusing or, you know, meditating or whatever. It's very possible, but people just don't have the tools to, you know, see the outcome, because mm-hmm. not everyone has an EEG head cap that's hooked up to a, you know, analytic
right.
thing.
Right.
So that's kind of elementary neural feedback in research. But what neural feedback is for most people, I would say the answer to this is kind of just meditate. Like sit with it, either guided meditations that are walking you through something, or, you know, attempts at, you know, personal meditation that's not guided, and try to listen to your brain and understand what it's doing as you go through thoughts. And, you know, like, as I talk about neurofeedback not being accessible, that's because people don't know how to listen appropriately. So even if I'm a neurophysiologist and very much focused on academia, I can still recognize the benefits of meditation and what it means neurophysiologically and with your mental health and with your self-work and all of that. So it can be a source of neurofeedback, I would think, because on some level you start listening to your brain with it, and then you can use that neurofeedback to get into a, you know, a mentality of accomplishing what you want to accomplish. I mean, it's those tasks that you think are too boring, or it's those goals that you think are too daunting, or those habits that just aren't forming for you. Well, if you sit and actually focus on them, that can help. I'm not going to say it's going to make it work entirely for everyone, but it can be a tool that benefits you.
And so, when you say sit and focus, like sit and kind of focus on doing it, or sit and focus on like thinking about doing it?
I mean, that's which meditation you choose to go down. You know, there, as you start diving into what meditation does, there's going to be the guided ones that really like walk you through it. And it's kind of like, I don't want to say handholding, because that sounds condescending.
Yeah.
But it's more like Sherpaing. Like it's a guide. It's gonna guide you through the thoughts that you're supposed to be thinking, or at least offer the right path. Then there are meditation styles that are like, don't think of anything. If a thought comes into your head, just let it go through. And it's that ability to not listen to every thought in your head that is kind of the neural feedback, because you start to realize that every thought that pops into your head isn't the most important thing that you need to dwell on. So you have that, you know, you start to train that feedback loop of, I'm only going to listen to the things I care about. You know, the thoughts that mean something to my goals are going to be the ones that are important. And that is a feedback of sorts, I think.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But in terms of like research neurofeedback, again, there's just not the, it's not the tools available in everyday life to use, like, what is your alpha power doing? Like, are you getting the right theta power while you sleep? Like, those just aren't out there. But neural feedback is literally just, if you can listen to your own brain, you can start adapting your behavior to do what you want it to.
I like it.
Yeah.
All right. Meditate more.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be my answer a lot of the time to most things. I mean,
it's a good answer. Yeah. That's because when it comes down to it, and we all need to, including me. So what have you done? And you talked a little bit about this, but add in anything that you maybe think of to enhance your home and make it like the optimal living experience for you. And I think, which is also an interesting especially living in a small space, like, it seems like you've done a lot of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, from the purely organizational, it's like you pare down, it's a casita. So like, I don't even have a full kitchen. So it's pared down any of the kitchen gear that I'd never used or didn't need frequently, or even like the one-off things. It's just like, get rid of it.
Yeah.
Let's use the thing, like, let's design how we use this space around things that we use frequently. So like, you know, an air fryer. I use an air fryer almost every meal because it's going to cook anything. And that makes it an important thing for my kitchen.
I just got one. I'm still learning how to use
it. It's so great. I mean, they're just wonderful.
I'm still confused. Can you put like raw meat in there?
Well, I'm vegan.
Oh, you're vegan.
So yeah, I don't know.
Fair enough.
Yeah. And yeah, I centered my kitchen around food prepping. So like my drawers are full of, you know, food prep containers and, you know, all of that. So it designs the space around the frequency of use. And, you know, same thing for the music area. It's like the things available are designed around, you know, me being able to just sit down there, you know, turn it on and play music. Everything's supposed to be as accessible as possible, so I don't waste time finding things or searching for them or putting other things away so that I can, you know, use a different space. So it's been very designed in that sense. For personal habits, I like keeping things as visual as possible, like not behind closed doors. So, you know, my art supplies are, you know, in a, like an open facing cabinet. My instruments are hanging on the wall. Because cooking is centered around these tools that are frequent, they're just on the counter. So I'm not like digging through the cabinet to find the thing, like, you know, the spiralizer for, you know, veggie noodles. Like, yep. I'm not digging for that ever because
yep.
I don't need it. I can just cut up vegetables. Like, it doesn't have to be that way. And even in the restroom, like, things are as visible as possible so that it's just like ease of use in the morning. And the workout station, like I said, it's just next to the bed. It's ease of use. And other than that, what's that?
I said, that's the way to think, like, yeah. The way you set it up.
Yeah, it's, and just... I used to think of it kind of like the opposite of out of sight, out of mind, but it's not even that. It's kind of just, it's not reminding me to use it. It's just removing the barrier to use it.
That's exactly what it is. It's just like, if there's one little step, it's going to reduce your chances of accessing the thing. Just because it's there, like, just because it's behind a thing. Even though when you're like putting it away, you're like, oh yeah, I'll use this, but you won't. Mm-hmm. And it's because of that weird barrier.
Yeah. And you start removing those barriers and all of a sudden you realize that like the best option is just no barrier.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, when I used to have a wood shop, it's like tools are, you know, on a shelf in a box behind some other tools. And it's like, okay, I forget it's there until I need it. So it doesn't prompt me to use it. It doesn't inspire me to use it. But if things are more open design, it's like,
There's that. I could use that for this. That could work. That could get me through this woodworking problem that's driving me crazy right now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And other than that, optimizing, like I have like a Google Home that has the alarm, like we talked about earlier, like the automation, but it not only, you know, it'll turn on the lights softly. It'll start playing like a meditation thing. And that way I just wake up with that. And some mornings I just kind of, you know, go back into my blankets. But other mornings it's like, no, I'm going to sit up and go through this meditation and really feel it. So it just provides that choice of it. It kind of sounds a little like I'm removing the intention from it, but I still think it's there because I'm deciding that that's how I want to wake up. You're right. Like, I'm setting the intention that when I wake up, there's going to be meditation ready to go. And some mornings I'm going to turn it off because I'm not ready for it.
And it's the same way of removing a barrier, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I do the same thing, not with a meditation, but with like what people refer to as an affirmation.
Mm-hmm.
I call them belief loops. And it's like the thing I want to like put in my head plays at 8:30 every morning. Because I notice, like, if I have to think about doing it or like playing it, even though it's not that big a deal to go on your phone, find the app, open the thing, I'll just forget to do it. Even that's something I need to be doing every day. So now I'm just like, why would I just have it play through Alexa every morning?
Yeah.
And then it's just, it plays. And
also, if you have to pick up your phone, like, and not only is it removing barriers, it's removing distractions, right?
Yeah.
So if you're digging through a shelf to find the thing you want, you're going to find other things and be like, oh yeah, there's that other thing that I want to play with or use. And the same thing with anything with a phone. It's like, yeah, I could wake up in the morning and navigate to the right app and find the right video.
But then you open and there's that, you know,
there's that, you know, list of notifications. You're like, damn it. And you, a half hour later, you realize, why have I not started my meditation? I have to get out of bed and get to work. I lost that half hour because of a distraction, which I don't know.
Yeah.
Sounds like I'm speaking to my own mental disorganization if I can't just use a phone for an app, but I think that's everyone.
No question. Yeah. I mean, and they're all designed for that. That's, you know,
It's gamified against us.
Yeah. We're at a losing. We're at a loss here. We got to find our ways around it.
$1 billion corporations are figuring out how to make us stay on our phone longer. So
absolutely.
If I cannot use it in the morning, I'm better off.
Yeah. Although I think Apple is doing some things to make it that somewhat less the case, especially with like on the new iOS 15, they're making you can set like different focus modes. So you can have like a personal mode, which will make it so no work notifications or no work apps are viewed. And then you can have like a work mode. So like it's the reverse of like all like social media and other apps like that aren't viewable, but you can get to your phone and email and stuff like that.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a pretty interesting concept. That I'm pretty excited to try.
Maybe I'll have to go back to Apple at some point. I've tried to set up the phone with like, you know, anti-distraction mode and limiting app times and all of that, and it helps tremendously. But it's still like feels a little too scheduled for life.
I'm with like, you there. Yeah. Sometimes you're like it's hard, like social, like Facebook and things are so hard, when at the same time, sometimes I need to get in them and use them. So if they're locked, like that can hinder me when I might be needing to do it for some business thing or whatever. Mm-hmm. Right. So yeah, it's tough.
Now, because, a lot of people use it for just normal communication, even business communication. It's like, I can't just shut off Facebook.
No,
I should be able to, but I can't.
I can't. Oh, what I would give. But then the one thing I do, like, I love using Freedom. It was perfect when I had a MacBook and then I got a PC and it just doesn't work as well on there. But like it making it so like all video viewing apps are blocked, like that's one I can't make an excuse for, like Netflix, HBO, Hulu.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when those are blocked, I was ultra productive. It helped. I'm not as bad as I definitely used to be, but I'll get sucked in still. And
yeah, absolutely.
I need those blocked, and it's just, it doesn't work as well on that computer. I'm like, I don't know what to do, because I haven't found one that's like works as well.
Just shut off all of that. Yeah. It's with the same kind of timer things. It's like, I don't need to have these available until, you know, 7 p.m. and I'm just going to sit down and actually watch something.
Exactly. Yeah. I give myself one day a week, Wednesday. Wednesday's my day off, and that's the day I can like,
it's much better than I do. But yeah.
Well, I'm not saying I do that now. I'm saying that's what I was doing.
Yeah.
Now it's kind of...
Yeah. If we could... maybe that's something that neural feedback and BCIs could help with in the future, to be able to detect like attentional loops and be able to say, hey, you're kind of not existing right now. You're a little too awake and not present. And give a reminder about it or something.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
I don't know if any research has been done into what the brain activity would look like when you're just doom scrolling, but that could be a nice little reminder of like, hey, you've kind of zoned out for a half hour, but you're awake. Maybe don't do that.
Do something.
Yeah.
Go draw or
go do anything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, I like it. So are there any things you've taken from what you've learned in your research and applied it to something in your home, personal life? I think I know what your answer is going to be.
I mean, in my immediate research, not really.
Okay.
I mean, it's all very focused on interventional treatment and like electrical stimulation. So I'm not really going home and zapping my own brain. But
fair.
From having an engineering education and having a neuroscience education, that has really shaped how I view like problems and challenges in life. So engineering wise, there's this thing called control theory. And in the very most basic sense, it's, you know, when there's a change in a system, you have called a perturbation. You have some response to that. And if you think of it like, just like a step change, so just like a immediate change to another level, you kind of have a response that approaches that curve, overshoots it, and then oscillates around it. And over time, that oscillation gets closer and closer to the step change. So that was kind of hammered into me in my undergrad, because it was a very engineering heavy bioengineering program. And it just made me think about like any kind of reaction or response I have to anything, or anyone does. It's like, if you're just aware that if you approach things with a little more control, you don't have these overshoots and you don't have these overcorrections and you don't have overreactions, basically. And you can still, you can just approach the right response without going through all the ridiculousness.
Could you give an example?
I mean, just any kind of interpersonal relationship. And it's, you know, very prevalent with most people is, you know, some unexpected change happens and people overreact like crazy. And it's just, you don't have to. Like, control theory kind of taught me that, like, yeah, there's always going to be a little bit of overshoot, but then you're just going to undershoot. And then, you know, every time you oscillate back over the desired outcome, it's going to be a little bit less. And with the right control, you know, in engineering, it's PID control. In personal life, it's just emotional control. It's, you know, with the right training and the right parameters, you can just kind of react appropriately. And engineering has kind of taught me that philosophy. Neuroscience-wise, I've realized that, you know, we are all just products of our environment and experience. So it's a lot of like compassion for other people that, you know, don't have the same privileges or don't have the same experience, that, you know, they are going to exist a certain way because of what they have experienced. Literally, because the brain is developed connections. It is a learning machine. And if you are exposing it to something that has a specific outcome, it's going to, you know, deepen that association. So, if you want to have a specific mindset, you have to start training that mindset. You have to start setting it up for yourself. And, you know, tying that in with the control stuff, it's, you know, if you want to be able to not overreact, or if you want to be able to have a certain response to some life perturbation, that's a skill you have to practice. Yeah. That is not something that you're just going to choose one day, because you literally have to change your brain and your memories and your associations in order to accomplish that. Yeah. And it's not a trivial task.
No,
it takes 18 years for humans to get from the mess of neurons to a functional adult. And that's at best, right?
Totally.
And, you know, this goes back to like BCI stuff. A lot of people want BCIs that you can just like install in your brain and use. That's never going to be a thing, because we're going to have to learn how to use that. And it's like giving someone who's only ever had one arm a second arm. They're not just going to know what to do with that. They might have a decent idea, but it's going to take years of training to be an expert with it. Same with any BCI, same with any kind of life philosophy. It's going to take a long time of training to be able to adapt to the appropriate outcome.
Yeah.
And that ties in even with like epigenetics, which isn't my expertise or anything, but it's just, everyone knows about genetics. It's our code that we, you know, we do things because of how we are. But epigenetics is how our environment and experiences affect our genetic expression. So, you know, think of it like twins grow up in two different environments. Well, they're going to have different genetics by the end of it. Like, they're not going to be the same as they were when they were born, because of how the world has changed their gene expression, or how their choices have changed their gene expression. So engineering and neuroscience and any kind of science training I've had has really formed this philosophy that we're in complete control of ourselves, but it takes a lot of fucking work. Like, it takes a lot of effort to be able to make the choices that put us in control of ourselves. And not everyone has the resources for that, or the introduction to that being a capability. So they're, you know, left in this state of, you know, believing that either they're wrong and they can't change, believing that they could change, but they don't have the power because of whatever reason. Yeah.
Have you seen Westworld?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. A lot. A lot. Good. Yeah. One of my favorite shows. I call this what you're describing here, playing your own piano. That's what I like labeled in my notes and everything. That's like what I was telling you, the loops that I play every morning. It's kind of like what I call them. And basically what like it is in the beginning of the intro to Westworld, you see one of the robots playing the piano, right? And I think that's an interesting interlude to You remember the pianos that, you know, the like the old
player pianos,
the player pianos that play them. So it's like the same kind of idea, because like it's, you know, you have this piano that's essentially playing itself, right? Mm-hmm. And that's I think that what they're the connection they were kind of trying to make there is like you have this robot that's like pre-programmed, kind of like the pianos were, that were in essence playing themselves but mm-hmm. weren't, because they're programmed. And same thing with the robots, right? They're initially they're programmed by humans to like do whatever they want to do, mm-hmm. but then some wake up, right? Some are able to make this crazy leap somehow to be able to take control over their actions and break from their programming,
mm-hmm.
right? And like
in the show, you know, spoiler alert, like what was that change? Was they were realizing that their internal voice wasn't someone else's. So correct. It was them assuming control. It was them saying like, wait, no, I am in control of my outcome. And, you know, same thing with people. Like, if you can really get to that point of my emotional, my neural, my genetic expression is, you know, the latter, maybe less so. My neural and my emotional expression are under my control. Then you start becoming more your own person. You start being able to accomplish, like, the goals that you're setting out to do.
Yeah. Those have been set for you, maybe, by...
Yeah. I mean, that's parents, the whole friends. Purpose of that show, right? Is personal autonomy and what is consciousness. So it's all about having the confidence that you do have that power.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just got to enact it.
Mm-hmm. I do love that in the opening scene of the robot playing the player piano, because it's just... this anachronism of the first entertainment automation, right? Player pianos. And maybe not the first ever, but like, is, you know, it? One of the originals. And oh, well, you know, we did that and humans played it and taught it how to play, but now it's bringing up this, you know, this reintroduction of a human playing something, but through the programming of the robot, but then realizing that they're kind of the same thing, so they kind of separate. And that, anyways, yeah, Westworld's fun.
So good. Oh man, that show, love it. But in the nature of continuing, what's a product under $100 that has made your home more enjoyable?
Oof, most of my products are under $100. I would say that's made my home more enjoyable. Oof.
You could also do just the one that's over 1,000, if that's an easier one to answer.
Yeah. Kind of stuck on like what things actually cost. I kind of forgot. I think the Google Home is fantastic. Like being able to set up an alarm and tying that with a light, like, really does help, because it's just like a nice soft way to wake up.
And oh, isn't that the best? Yeah, that's really how I wake up too. And I have mine set up so that I have different colors.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Like, when I wake like it at, let's see, 7 is when I'm like supposed to get up. So it's green, like go.
Mm-hmm.
And then it turns to purple at 7:30, like, but you should beat the fuck up.
Yeah.
And then at 8, it goes to red, or like, dude,
you gotta go.
Are you not fucking up yet?
That's good. I didn't think about that. I like that a lot. I don't know if that whole system costs under $100, but like that's a really, like, even the teensiest bit of automation is really nice. For just like making my life smoother, like just a good set of meal prep stuff, Tupperwares and a drawer that's just dedicated to that, because, you know, it's visually like when it starts emptying, you're just like, or when it's empty, it's your fridge is probably stocked full of meals. All right. As it fills back up, you start getting a reminder like, hey, I need to set aside the day to meal prep again, or have that routine or whatever you do.
Yeah, I like it.
And those are like, those are pretty accessible at the Container Store or something. Like you get a set of 10 or so for well under $100, and like get the glass ones with like the rubber seals, and they don't leak in your bag or anything. And it's a good amount of dedication to taking care of yourself. Either automation, products, or health products like that, you know, and I consider meal prepping a health product.
I'd agree.
Yeah. Or just a good set of dumbbells that are like the right weight for you. Like you're talking about earlier, you could do calisthenics and push-ups and everything, and you could augment that just by having, like, you know, one set of dumbbells that fit for you. You don't always need to be increasing weight. You just need to be doing something regularly. Absolutely. So you don't need a full set. like a rack full of dumbbells. You don't need the Bowflex ones that like dial into certain right, things and yeah. cost $1,000. Like you can get, just go to, go to Big Five, find the ones that work for you yeah. and buy two of them and yeah. just yeah. have those near you.
I mean, you can even do some crazy workouts with a 5 pound, no matter yeah, who you are. Exactly. You just like hold those for yeah, 10 minutes. Exactly. That'll kill you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, I guess, one of those three for under $100 have been really transformational in the last couple of years, really focusing on the health with meal prepping, having something that I feel more exertion with a workout. Like, yeah, you could do pushups and everything, but having something that you really push yourself with, or, unloading some of the trivial shit to automation, anything like that. Yeah.
All about that for mm-hmm. sure. Love it. Cool, man. So anything else you'd like to tell people, any last thoughts? And then as well as that, just anything you want to shout out, like
your
Instagram again, any other websites or anything?
I'm going to touch back to the question of like what's over $1,000.
Oh, sure.
And literally I don't think I own anything over $1,000. I don't think there's anything that's really that expensive that's necessary. Any of the wood shop tools, anything.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like those are, a few hundred for some of them.
Yeah.
The most expensive thing I probably have is it's a music looper. It's like a Boss 505.
Yeah.
And it might be like $600. And that's really nice for, being wanting to mess around with music and not having a band.
Oh, you absolutely.
Just like set up a track and play on top of it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But that might be the most expensive thing. So like the point I want to make there is you don't need expensive shit. Like even quality things aren't always that expensive. I'm really racking my brain to think if there's anything I have.
That's I think I even me,
my
dude,
car
I,
is
car or yeah. probably your computer.
I mean, yeah, I use a Microsoft Surface and it was like $700.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, damn.
And I have a homebrew PC that I, used to use more for work, but
yeah.
But like I built that and that was definitely under $1,000. So yeah, I don't think anything.
Oh.
So yeah. Anyways. All right, cool. I'd be really intrigued to hear other people's answers on that and what $1,000 thing really transformed their life. Because I think it's more telling that there's not many expensive things are going to transform your life.
As I've asked people this, that's about the response I've gotten. Which has been interesting.
If I had $1,000 to spend, it'd be on a vacation. It'd be on an experience. Anyways. As for shout outs, no, not really much. My work is very, government funded and boring. To most people, because it's all scientific articles and things.
But to me, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
I nerd out.
It's, I have a website that talks about some of it, justincetanner.com. There's an Insta I do for art things, craftwork as art.work. So there's a dot, a period in the middle of artwork. If you want to check those out, go for it. And
he does great photography. He did mine.
Yeah, I did some shoots for JP, and I have a maternity shoot on Sunday.
Nice.
Yeah, I'd never done that, and that'd
be an interesting one.
It's like the first time I'm doing a shoot for someone I don't know either.
Oh, cool.
It's like a friend of a friend, and I'm just like, you're trusting me to come take photos of like your unborn child? Okay, sure.
Let's do it.
Yeah. So check those out if you feel inclined. And other than that, not much personally that I have to shout out.
Dope, man.
Yeah.
Great time.
It was a really good talk.
Yeah. All right. See you on the next one.
Absolutely.